Well, one thing I think we all could readily agree upon is that life at times is very challenging. And we have difficulties and issues that we deal with that force us, if nothing else does, to turn to God and to show our confidence in Him and to look to Him to help us in those times of particular need. We understand as we face issues and challenges and difficulties in our lives more clearly that we rely on His blessing and on His strength and not on our own strength. We all want to have strength, but the strongest or the best, most important strength we can have is our reliance upon God, not a strength that we have ourselves. But even as we deal with life in general and sometimes difficulties in particular, some days we feel more confident than we do on other days. Maybe it has to do with how recently you ate or how you slept last night or other physical kinds of elements in our environment. But often it's just a matter of anxiety or fear or concern or worry that can accompany our trials. So a question I have for you today is, what is it that prevents us from being as confident and as strong in faith as we want to be? And how can we exercise faith so that we will become stronger in it and more stable? Is there something that we can do that will strengthen our faith? Maybe we could look at it another way. Are there things that we might do that would weaken our faith? It seems to me that without meaning to do so, we sometimes fall into patterns of action or thought that actually diminish faith. This afternoon, we're going to kind of look at faith through the back door. We're going to look at faith from this aspect of what we might be doing that would weaken our faith. And if we can see those things that are pitfalls that we would do inadvertently that would weaken our faith, then hopefully then we can avoid those and in that same way then strengthen the faith that we have. The title I've given to the sermon this afternoon is Enemies of Faith. We're going to identify some specific characteristics or, I guess, practices or things that we might do that would have a negative impact on our faith. As I mentioned, I think of these as pitfalls, a way of thinking or a way of behaving that might serve to undermine or diminish or weaken our faith, and things that we don't do intentionally but might kind of stumble into. Now, as I begin, I want to emphasize that I believe that we are a faithful congregation of God's church. I constantly see examples among the entire membership of those who are standing strong in the face of life and, in many cases, severe challenges. Personally, I find that both encouraging and also humbling, because I know that you are people of faith, dealing in some cases with some very serious situations. So I don't mean to imply that we don't have faith, but I also know that humanly we deal with anxiety, we deal with fear, we deal with just general ups and downs as we make our journey. And there are times when we wonder what God is doing. Or we wonder why God doesn't seem to be doing, or when He's going to do something. So as we go through these points today, maybe you can give thought to some of the things that you may have found troubling, that you maybe are weary of or weary because of, some of the difficulties, whatever it is that causes you anxiety and fear, and consider whether any of these enemies of faith that we're going to talk about may play a part in some of the struggles that you have. I've got four. We'll try to get through all of them with you today. So let's get into it. Let's talk about the first enemy of faith, and they're not in any particular order, but the first one we'll talk about is impatience. Patience is one of the most difficult qualities for us to develop and to consistently practice. Most of us, and I put myself at the top of the list, are wired to be impatient. We become anxious very quickly if something is not the way that we would like for it to be or the way that it should be. I get frustrated over little things, and sometimes I get discouraged over bigger things. But certainly I've always noticed how much better I feel and how much more positive I am if I can just be patient. It's easy to be impatient even with God, because we know that God can answer and provide what we're looking to Him for. And it's easy for us to become discouraged as we're waiting for God to answer. So let's talk about, first of all, the enemy of impatience and how it can impact our faith. We'll begin in James, the first chapter. James chapter 1. Where we can read a passage that we often look at and maybe sometimes puzzle over. James chapter 1, verse 2. At the very outset, or the beginning of this epistle, James writes, "My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials." Now, we're not going to be focusing on that particular point today. It's something we have talked about and you've heard many messages about and you've thought a lot about, I'm sure. But we understand that ultimately trials are of very high value to us. They're very important as God is working in our lives, and they have a very positive outcome. So even though they're not enjoyable, we should recognize the value and the importance of trials. And there are various trials, all kinds of different, wide variety of issues and challenges that we deal with. And so we recognize, at least intellectually, if not emotionally, that we should be positive about and recognize the value of trials, and we can still remain positive and optimistic even when we're suffering these various kinds of trials. But the way that James develops this thought is that we count it joy, or we consider the value and the importance of it, because or knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. A reason that we are optimistic or positive even as we face those difficulties is because we understand that those times in our lives that are difficult are to produce patience. We talked last week about the fruit or the spiritual fruit that a person can develop. We were talking about the parable of the sower, and the final category of people in that parable are the ones who are spiritually productive, 30, 60, or 100-fold. The produce, or the product that they produce, are spiritual results. And this is one of the products. We produce patience as a result of the testing of our faith. Now, the word testing is important because it means to prove, to establish, or as it says in 1 Peter, it's a matter of cleansing or purifying our faith. Our faith is established by the trials and the challenges we face. God's not trying to break us or to discourage us. He's working in our lives to establish and to prove and to cleanse our faith. And those instances produce patience. The, The word patience in the English language means the capacity to tolerate delay, trouble, or suffering without being angry or upset. The capacity to tolerate delay, trouble, or suffering without becoming angry or upset. So it follows that to be impatient means to show a tendency to be quickly irritated or provoked. Now, the dictionary definition for patience and impatience, for that matter, seem to be mostly oriented toward dealing with the daily annoyances and inconveniences of life. We all have to put up with and deal with things that are just annoying, that are inconvenient, that are frustrating, that could make us either angry or just impatient, irritated, provoked. We have to learn how to deal with those issues and maintain our composure and not be impatient in that regard. But the scripture here is talking more about the kinds of trials that are more difficult, that are more serious, and not just the day-to-day annoyances. The Greek word that's translated patience, that's used here in this verse, might be more accurately translated endurance or perseverance. Endurance or perseverance. That definition implies an ongoing difficulty that extends over a period of time. Sometimes over, at least from our perspective, a very long period of time. The word persevere means to continue a course of action even in the face of difficulty or with little or no prospect of success. I find that definition to be very interesting in light of the trials that we sometimes face. To continue a course of action, even in the face of difficulty or with little or no prospect of success. There are times that we deal with issues in our lives where we don't see how there can possibly be a good outcome. We don't see how it's going to be resolved. And we certainly don't see in any hope in our immediate situation. But to persevere means to continue in faith, even though we face difficulty, sometimes extreme difficulty, and there may be little or no prospect of success. The word endure, again, this word in the Greek could be translated endurance or perseverance. The word endure means to suffer something painful or difficult patiently. To patiently suffer something painful or difficult. So we deal with difficulties and pain without becoming upset, angry, irritated, or provoked. I've mentioned this before. The thing about patience is you can't develop patience except when you need patience. There's no way for patience to be developed in our lives when everything is going well, as if that happens. When everything is smooth and easy in the way that you want it to be, there's no need for patience. But when things are difficult or challenging, annoying or painful, then we need patience. And so we both exercise it and we strengthen it at the same time. Now these words, endurance and perseverance, also imply, as I've mentioned, the passing of time. A particular event. Is God punishing you? Is God cleansing you? Is God chastising you? Do we have certain trials? Well, in some cases, of course, there is a pretty clear answer. There are lessons that we learn from each of those circumstances. But a general answer is, whatever the trial is, the one purpose of it is to teach us the lesson of patience. It is to produce patience. That's difficult for us. We don't like learning the lesson of patience. We're too impatient to learn the lesson of patience. But that's what God intends to build into our character. Paul puts his trials and the trials of others who were also apostles and leaders in the church at his time in the context of the entire church and how the church can benefit. Turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 1. 2 Corinthians chapter 1. He speaks of the difficulties that he encounters, and I think that he's speaking here not just of himself personally or the membership in general, but of the kinds of trials that those who were the apostles and the leaders of the church were dealing with. But he emphasizes that it is for the benefit of the entire church. I'm going to just break into the introduction here. I'm going to begin in verse 5 of 2 Corinthians 1. I'm going to read it to you from the New International Version. I think it helps clarify the language. 2 Corinthians 1, verse 5, "For just as the sufferings of Christ flow into our lives, so also through Christ our comfort overflows. If we are distressed, it is for your comfort and salvation. And if we are comforted, it is for your comfort, which produces in you patient endurance of the same sufferings we suffer." In other words, Paul is saying here that what he and the other leaders in the church suffered on behalf of and to serve the churches were for their benefit. And as they were comforted, as they were helped in their trials and their situations, then the membership was to learn not only from the trials that they saw their leaders enduring, but also from the comfort or the intervention that they saw that God gave them. And the result, which is again what I want to focus on, is that it should produce in you patient endurance. I would find in this writing or in this description a point that we learn from each other's examples. I've mentioned that we have some examples in our congregation of people who are enduring extremely difficult circumstances. But they are standing strong. They are receiving the help and the comfort they need to deal with it. And as we see them experiencing those things, we find comfort, and it is an example to us of patient endurance. We can look to that as well as and recognize that when we face serious issues, we must do the same. We must endure patiently as we see others are around us. What do we accomplish if we become impatient? Nothing really. All we do is hurt ourselves more deeply. The more upset we become, the more annoyed, the more we're discouraged, then it begins a very negative cycle. Nothing is accomplished through impatience, but much is accomplished when we are patient, when we endure those difficulties without becoming angry or upset. It establishes in us the kind of character that God wants us to have. It produces the patience that we read of there in James. Let's look back at an example of an impatient person and see the consequences of that in 1 Samuel 13. 1 Samuel 13. There's kind of a technical, textual problem or issue with this particular chapter. I'm not going to take time to try to untangle it. But it's a matter of verse 1 of 1 Samuel 13. It reads very awkwardly in the King James and in the New King James. It's talking about Saul and early in his reign as king over Israel. It says in 1 Samuel 13, 1, that Saul reigned 1 year, and when he had reigned 2 years over Israel, he chose for himself 3,000 men. Odd sentence. And the reason that it's comes across so strangely is because apparently the Hebrew text itself is corrupted in some way. And so this is a literal translation of that text, but it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. If you look ahead to other examples or other places where a king is introduced, you see that generally it'll say that he was such and such years of age, and he reigned for a number of years, and he was evil, either evil or righteous. Probably that's the way this sentence should be worded if the Hebrew text were intact. So the New International puts it this way in 1 Samuel 13:1, Saul was 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned over Israel 42 years. Doesn't sound much like what you see in your King James, but that's probably the intent of the introduction to Saul here that's given here. Anyway, I don't want to get bogged down in that technicality. What we want to look at is what happened to Saul. You see, Saul was told, it says in verse 8, to wait for Samuel to come to him, and that Samuel then would bring a burnt offering. And as the priest, he would conduct offerings on behalf of Saul and the army that was with him. Saul was to wait, it says in verse 8, for 7 days for Samuel to come. But Samuel did not arrive when he said that he would. And Saul kind of lost control of the situation. It says that the people were scattered from him, from Saul. So Saul, in an attempt to salvage the situation, became impatient, and he conducted the sacrifice himself, rather than waiting for the priest to do so as he had been told to do. Now, as in one of those isn't that the way it goes kind of moments, as soon as Saul finished making the sacrifice, Samuel showed up. And he said, you know, well, what's going on here? And Saul tried to justify himself. He said, well, first of all, it's the people's fault. Verse 11, the people started to scatter. They were out of control. So I had to do something to get them under control. And secondly, it's your fault, Samuel, because you didn't come when you said you were going to be here. And so I had to do something. I had to step in and take action. Verse 13, Samuel said to Saul, you have done foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now, well, then he goes on, we'll get to that in a moment. Saul behaved foolishly by being impatient and taking the matter into his own hands. Rather than being faithful to the instruction he was given and waiting, realizing that somehow the situation would be salvaged if he obeyed, but he wasn't willing to do that. He behaved rashly, foolishly, and impatiently. And notice the result of that impatience. In verse 14, now your kingdom shall not continue. Let's back up to the previous sentence. It says that you have not kept the commandment of your Lord. For now, the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. Now, God actually did make that promise to David, who was the next king. Saul had the opportunity to have received that perpetual covenant if he had been an obedient and a patient person. But he behaved, again, rashly and foolishly. He impatiently took charge of the situation. But now it says, your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought for himself a man after his own heart. Important lesson. What does it take to be a man after God's heart? Patience. Patience which will lead to obedience. And of course, it implies faithfulness, of trusting that what the instruction is what needs to be. Saul behaved in a way that was not respectful of God or of God's servant. You can compare this to David. We see here again, God is seeking someone after his own heart. That's a description of David, isn't it? In 1 Samuel 16, verse 7, it says that God looks on the heart, not on the outward appearance. In Acts 13, 22, it says that David was a man after God's own heart. David was faithful and loyal. He patiently endured. And he made a lot of mistakes. You read through the rest of this book and in 2 Samuel, you see that David stumbled from time to time, and he stumbled big time. But he had a heart that was willing to endure and to continue, and when he repented, he did so sincerely. He patiently endured. Saul's impatience illustrated his attitude, his heart, his frame of mind. So, a lesson we learn from this is that we must not expect God to answer on our time schedule. We must learn to be patient. We must learn to acknowledge that God is the one who will establish when and how he will answer us. And we can't make excuses and justify behavior that is rash and impatient. Turn back to Hebrews 10. Hebrews chapter 10. We see here again that the importance of patience in accomplishing what God is going to accomplish in our lives. Hebrews 10, verse 35, "Do not cast away your confidence, which has great reward, for you have need of endurance." You have need of that patient willingness to continue so that after you've done the will of God, you may receive the promise. We must have the strength of endurance and patience and not become impatient. If we become impatient, that means that we lose our context, we lose our view of God and what he's doing, and we are apt to behave in a way that's not going to be pleasing to him. We aren't waiting for him. We're not persevering and enduring. We're not learning the lesson of a trial, as James pointed out. So, one of the primary enemies of faith is impatience. Now, impatience can take several different forms, or can have several different can appear and make itself present in our lives in different ways. Another enemy of faith, which kind of springs from impatience, is self-will. Many times we think of ourselves as being weak, but it's amazing how strong our self-will is. We all have a strong sense of self and a desire for things to be accomplished or done in a way that is satisfying or pleasing to us. Faith requires that we submit our will to God and accept his will in our lives. But by nature, our will is for things to be our way, and by nature, our will is that we find comfort and relief, not to be in a situation where we have to continue to endure. Self-will can take many forms, and it can cause many complications. Let's look at an example in Genesis 15. Abraham is called the father of the faithful. And we look at an example here in Genesis 15 that will illustrate the danger or the hazards of self-will. As we do this, I don't mean in any way to be disrespectful of Abraham or to take away from what God says of his great faithfulness, but it's recorded here in Scripture, and it's an example of rationalization, justification, and imposing self-will. It says in verse 1 that the word of God came to Abram, and then in verse 2 he makes a promise to Abram. See, Abram was concerned because he had no children, and at this point a servant who had been born in his home was the heir was Abram's heir. And God was assuring him that in verse 4 that this servant born in your household will not be your heir, but one who will come from your own body shall be your heir. And then he went on to promise that his descendants would be as the number of stars in the heaven. So a profound promise is made to Abram that God would give him a son, give him an heir. But it didn't happen right away. It says in chapter 16, verse 1, Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, and she had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. And so Sarai said to Abram, "See now, the Lord has restrained me from bearing children. Please go into my maid, and perhaps by her I shall obtain children." So they began to reason about how God was going to provide this heir. Now, to be fair, it doesn't say in chapter 15 that Sarai would be the mother. It just said that Abraham would be the father. And so they began again to impose their solution to the situation. They laid their will into the circumstance and made the decision that this would be the way that God would provide an heir for Abram. Well, it did not turn out well. God did provide an heir through Sarah, as we know, but this young man, this son named Ishmael, kind of became a problem for the people of Israel, the rest of Abraham's descendants, from that time forward, even to this day. Abram imposed his will into the situation and his solution to the matter. Abraham also, on other occasions, imposed his will by claiming that Sarah was his sister. Now, he was fudging a bit there. He was half right. He was trying to protect her from, or himself, from these evil kings that he was afraid would do him harm if they found out that Sarah was his wife. But rather than being completely truthful, he tried to hide behind this semi-truth and solve the solution himself, or solve the problem himself by claiming that Sarah was his sister. Again, it's a matter of imposing his will or his solution, projecting that into the situation rather than waiting and allowing God to solve the problem. We're told in 2 Corinthians 5, a very short and simple statement that means a lot in our lives. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 7. Paul says that we walk by faith and not by sight. We walk by faith. We learn to pray, as Jesus taught us in Matthew 6, "Your will be done." It's not easy to walk by faith because we can't always see the solution, or we can't always see what we want the solution to be. But remember the definition of persevere. To persevere means to continue a course of action even in the face of difficulty or with little or no prospect of success. That is what we are doing when we walk by faith. If we walk by sight, or if we expect to be able to see all of the solution and see how everything is going to work out, then we are imposing our will into the situation. We walk by God's will. We walk by faith and leave matters to Him. If we try to step in and solve the situation ourselves, again, applying our own rationalization and justification, then we're going to complicate matters. Self-will will become an obstacle to faith if we try to impose what we are looking for a solution to a situation. It's very unnatural for us to leave something in God's hands. It's more natural for us to try to solve it for ourselves. So self-will is also an enemy of, it takes away from, it minimizes faith. All right, so let's consider then another of the enemies of faith that we can identify. Another enemy of faith is ignorance. Not nice to be called ignorant, but ignorance is an obstacle or an enemy to faith. Sometimes our faith can be shaken if we expect something from God that He has not promised. To be ignorant just means, of course, to lack knowledge. Sometimes if we expect something from God that He never promised, then we will set ourselves up to be very disappointed. So we need to understand what God promises, and for that matter, what He does not promise. Now, I'm not going to go through all the promises God has made to us. You can, as you read the Bible, you can just make a note along the way of all the times when God makes a promise that we know that we can anticipate that He will fulfill. But let's take a look at a couple of them to help us put in context this idea that we should not be looking for something that's not promised. Let's look at here in Luke chapter 12. I read it from Luke here because it's the same point that we find in Matthew 6, but we don't read Luke 12 as often, so the wording is a little different. And sometimes wording can become so familiar that it loses some of its impact. So let's look at this point that Jesus makes in Luke 12. The context begins in verse 22, where He's talking about not worrying about providing for the needs that we have. Verse 23, He says, life is more than food and the body is more than clothing. The animals are cared for, He goes on to mention in verse 24. You can't change things by worrying, as He mentions in verse 25. So, verse 26, if you're not able to do the least, if you're not able to make anything happen by worrying, then don't worry. Why are you anxious, it says in verse 26. And He concludes this section by asking them, or referring to them as people of little faith. So this is about faith as we read through this section. Faith that God will provide for us and that God will take care of us. Don't seek what you should eat or what you should drink. Don't have an anxious mind. Okay, here's the point in verse 30. For all these things the nations of the world seek after, your Father knows you need these things. Here's the promise then. God promises to provide for us the things that we need. That's really not enough, is it? I mean, that's the way we might look at it. God provides for us the things that we need. Many times in our lives, we begin looking for things that are additional blessings or comforts or luxuries that we'd like to have. And we live in a society where there's a lot of stuff out there that we can enjoy. And we also have the feeling that when we obey God, he's going to bless us. Well, that's generally true. But we need to be careful that we don't start looking for things that God has not promised us. He's not promised us wealth. He's not promised us the nicest house on the block, the newest car in the driveway. He's not promised us all the luxuries and the comforts and the securities physically that we'd like to have. He's promised to supply our needs. That's what God has promised. Now, he does bless us beyond that, absolutely. And I don't mean to say that he doesn't. But when we have a situation, a trial, a need in our lives, or something that's happening in our lives, we need to be careful that we recognize that God is faithful. He always provides what we need. He always has, and he always will. It may not be what we're looking for, but he has promised to provide our needs. When we look beyond that, then we need to realize that, well, sometimes God might allow us to have more than what we just really need, but it's beyond what he promised, is that he'll provide those needs for us. Kind of lowers the threshold of satisfaction, of realization, and of faith that, yeah, God has provided for my needs. And at times we might have to deal with the desire for more than that, but he's promised us that he'll provide for us what we need. And then he goes on, and this is even more important. Your Father knows that you need these things, but seek the kingdom of God, and these things will be added to you. So God will provide for us as we seek his kingdom. Then verse 32, do not fear, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. There's another promise that God has made, that Jesus makes here, of the Father. It is our Father's good pleasure. It is his desire and his delight to give us the kingdom. So as we are looking for other things along the way in our lives, sometimes we need to try to put it in better context. Not be ignorant of what God has promised and what he has not promised. Something else he promises, and it's recorded in Acts 14:22. Paul here is visiting the churches in southern Galatia and going back to encourage them as they are brand new churches, really, and God is establishing them in that region. So he goes back to the cities, it says in verse 21, of Lystra, Iconium, and Antioch to strengthen the souls of the disciples and encourage them to continue in the faith, to continue in what they believe and to continue in their trust for God. Encourage them to continue in the faith and saying to them, here's a promise, we must, through many tribulations, enter the kingdom of God. One of the things that God says we will experience is difficulty. Tribulation means stress or challenge and difficulty, difficult experiences. We're promised that we will experience many difficulties on our way to the kingdom. So we should be aware of that. And when we face those difficulties, we're not shocked. We realize that this is a promise that God made, that he would work in our lives. We saw that in James, where we started, right? He'll work in our lives to prepare us for his kingdom. And that is a positive result beyond what we can really even describe or appreciate yet. That God is working in our lives to lead us to the kingdom. So we should not be ignorant of what God has promised. He's promised to provide our needs. He's promised to make a way for us to be a part of his kingdom. And he's promised that along the way we're going to have some challenges, some difficulties. All that is part of the package. All that is part of what God is doing to work in our lives. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Let's look at just one more promise. It relates to the challenges and the difficulties we have, the way that God works in our lives. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13. We should remember and not be thrown off by the fact that God allows difficulties and stress and trials. It's part of the way he works in our lives. It doesn't mean that he's not working or answering our prayers or taking care of us. It's the way that he's working in our lives, through those challenges, and to give us the chance to build patience along with many other godly characteristics. But notice the promise here in 1 Corinthians 10:13. No temptation or difficulty has overtaken you except such as is common to man. But God is faithful. You know, faith is a lesson that we're trying to learn and trying to build into our character, to be trustworthy is what the word faithful means here in this case. But that's what we can put our trust in God because he is trustworthy, he is faithful, and he will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able. But with the temptation or the difficulty, will make a way of escape that you may be able to bear it. That is another promise that God gives to us. We will endure difficulties. We will experience difficulties, but they will not ever be beyond what we can bear. We also know from Romans 8:28 that eventually the circumstances in our lives always work out for the good. So we should make an effort through our study of God's word to recognize what he has promised and what he has not promised. And if we are looking for something in our lives that God never promised he would do, then we're going to be disappointed. We're going to be hurt. We know that he allows some very difficult things to happen. We're experiencing some of those things right now as a congregation. But it doesn't mean that God isn't working in our lives, and he never promised that he would provide everything for us and heal us in every instance and bring us through every circumstance unscathed. He said that he will allow us to suffer and build those qualities of patience in our lives. So don't fall into the pitfall of ignorance. Don't be unaware of what God has promised. Because what he has promised, you can lay claim to. And what he has not promised, don't look for. Don't expect. Let's talk about one last enemy of faith. There are many others, and you can take these four that we're going to look at briefly today and expand on them and add others to the list. But here's another enemy of faith, and that is doubt. Doubt is a frame of mind that is confused and divided, where we wonder what is the truth or wonder what is the way. And doubt leads directly to fear. And when we act out of fear, then we're certainly going to stumble along the way. Doubt and fear will rob us of the confidence that we can have. Now, we're all vulnerable to doubt. We're all vulnerable to fear. Let's look at another example. Now, I mentioned Abraham, and we saw where he imposed his own will into a situation that caused some difficulty. But he is called the father of the faithful. Let's look at an example from the prophet Elijah. Elijah is the most revered prophet in all of the Old Testament, in the Jewish religion. He was John the Baptist came in the power and spirit of Elijah. And at the end time, there'll be one who will come again in that same power and spirit. So he's used as an example of one who, in a powerful way, does God's work. But let's look at something that happened to Elijah back in 1 Kings. In chapter 18, and I'm not going to read there, but you see a description of when Elijah challenged the prophets of Baal. You probably remember the account where he challenged them to pray to their God to accept the sacrifice that they were offering. And of course, Baal did not answer, did not accept the sacrifice they were bringing to him. But when Elijah prayed to God, then there was a miraculous event where God accepted that sacrifice. And even then the prophets of Baal who were there were consumed in the fire that was part of God's sacrifice. So it was a great miracle, really, that Elijah was part of. This event where the prophets of Baal were humiliated and defeated by the power of God through Elijah, who called on God for his intervention or for his help. Immediately after that, Elijah prayed to God to send rain to end a long drought that had plagued the people of Israel. And God heard that prayer, and the drought was broken. So in chapter 18, you see two just amazing miracles that Elijah was responsible for and that God performed through him. But then in verse 19, we find that Elijah, after these two incredible experiences, turns tail and runs when Jezebel threatens him. He began to doubt. He didn't continue to be strong in his confidence. And fearful, he ran. Ahab, chapter 19, verse 1, told Jezebel all that Elijah had done, how he had executed all the prophets with the sword, and Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah, saying, "So let the gods do to me and more, if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time." So she threatened to kill Elijah. Elijah turned and ran. He ran for his life, it says in verse 4. He went a day's journey into the wilderness, and he came and he sat down under a broom tree, and he prayed that he would die. It's amazing that he had that, or felt that way immediately after he had experienced such an amazing and incredible miracle. Now, we're vulnerable to doubt and fear ourselves. Even as we look to God and we know that God answers our prayers, he acts on our behalf, and we, in many instances, have seen or experienced amazing miracles in our own lives, we still are vulnerable to doubt, to weakness in our faith, to not having trust in God to continue to act on our behalf. In fact, you've probably noticed this yourself, that many people who experience amazing miracles in their lives later lose their faith and stumble and don't even continue in God's way. Mr. Franks wrote of that in his letter. I'll pick up a paragraph here. He's been writing about the Israelites and how they did not remember and did not have faith, even though God intervened for them time after time. But Mr. Franks writes, "Before we judge the Israelites too harshly, we should consider our own lives. I've witnessed a number of miracles in the church over the years and was inspired when those events happened. But I have to admit that it wasn't long until I was back in my regular routine, not giving a lot of thought to the miracle." How easily we forget. Now, Mr. Franks did not abandon his faith, but he's making the point that sometimes even a major and miraculous occurrence or event in our lives will fade. And we can again return to our previous patterns, and in some cases even begin or return to having mixed feelings and not have the confidence that is strong in God. We can begin ourselves to doubt. Let's go back to James 1 again. We were there a little bit ago. Let's continue reading where we left off. James, the first chapter. In this context here, James also speaks of those who doubt and how God looks upon those who are doubtful. James chapter 1, verse 6. Now, he's been talking about wisdom, and if you lack wisdom, then pray for it. So he's specifically talking about praying for wisdom, but it applies in a general sense to whatever we come to God for. In verse 6, it says, "Let him ask in faith with no doubting. For he who doubts is like a wave of the sea driven and tossed by the wind. Let not that man suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord. He is double-minded and unstable in all his ways." Double-minded is a Greek term that means literally to have two minds. One part of our mind says yes, the other part of our mind says, I'm not so sure, I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. It's easy for us to be in that position where we begin to wonder and to not be certain and confident as we look to God for his help in whatever way, whether it's a prayer, whether it's a situation or a need that we're coming before God about. If we are not confident and certain, then God is not pleased with our approach, with our prayer. Here's what the expositor's commentary says about this passage in James 1. It says, "To believe is to be confident that God will give what is requested. It is to expect him to do so. The extent of faith that God looks for is emphasized by the words, not doubt. The true force in the Greek of this expression is not doubt at all. The Greek word translated doubt describes one who is divided in his mind, who wavers between two opinions. One moment he voices the yes of faith, the next moment is the no of disbelief. Such an attitude is graphically illustrated by a wave of the sea. Completely lacking stability, it is blown and tossed by the wind." That's the way we are emotionally or spiritually if we doubt. We're just tossed back and forth, uncertain, wondering, not confident in what we are asking of God. That's not something that he can answer because we aren't certain ourselves what it is we're even looking to him for. This reference to the sea, the winds blowing the sea and tossing the waves in the wind may bring to mind Peter's example in Matthew 14. We've read many times of how Peter saw Jesus walking toward him across the water, and he said, "If it's you, then call me and I'll come as well." And Peter was able to walk on that water as long as he kept his eyes on Jesus Christ. But when he looked around and saw the danger that he was in, the storm and the waves, and he realized that this is impossible, this can't be done, then he doubted, and he immediately began to sink. The point is that faith does not function where there is doubt. Faith does not function in an environment where there is doubt. And so it is a serious enemy, something for us to focus on and to concentrate our confidence and not allow doubtful thoughts or fears to enter in as we're practicing or relying on God and looking to him. It requires faith of us. We'll conclude in Hebrews 11 where this is spoken of, this need, requirement for faith. Hebrews 11, verse 6. Hebrews 11, verse 6. It says, without faith it is impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he's a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. Faith is necessary in order for us to please God, because to not have faith means that we don't believe God. Consider how insulting it is to God if we doubt him, if we disbelieve him. It's a denial of who he is, of what he has promised, what he has done. Ultimately, it's a denial of Jesus Christ and his sacrifice. We don't trust God to do what he says he will do. And that is truly insulting to him, and we cannot please him if we have that mixed frame of mind. Another paragraph from Mr. Frank's letter. He writes that faith underpins everything we do as Christians. Without faith, we know it's impossible to please God. The challenge for all of us is to maintain our faith in spite of all the distractions that exist in life. How can we do that? Christ's parable in Luke 18, where he talks about prayer, Christ's parable encouraged his disciples to pray always and never lose heart. In other words, faith increases when you put your relationship with God as your number one priority, praying daily, never giving up in spite of the difficulties that life may throw at you. And life will throw at us plenty of difficulties. We know that all too well. We know from our own experience, even day to day, that we must keep God as our number one priority. And when we do that, we'll be able to focus on him and avoid pitfalls or enemies that rob us, that diminish our faith. It's an essential aspect of our spiritual and emotional health as a Christian. We can concentrate and focus and work to exercise the faith that God grants to us. So, as you deal with elements and situations in your life, give some thought to what may undermine or weaken your faith. As we avoid those pitfalls, we can strengthen our faith, become more stable and confident, and certainly be more successful as Christians, as the children of God working toward his kingdom.